This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The latest in the presidential results. Eyes were on Nevada today, which did release an additional vote count about 2 hours ago, but not enough additional votes for the AP to call the state for one candidate or the other. The counts go on, and we are still at this moment without a projected winner. Here's Vice President Joe Biden's campaign manager, Jen O'Malley Dillon, in an update this morning.
I think the story of today is going to be a very positive story for the vice president, but also one where folks are going to need to stay patient and stay calm. The counting is happening. It's going to take time.
Meanwhile, the majority of President Trump's communications today have been through Twitter. Earlier today, he tweeted in all caps, "Stop the count." Joining us now with a more complete update is WBUR's Callum Borchers. Hey there, Callum.
Hey, Tiziana.
Count, you know, things are changing by the minute. What is the latest?
Well, the latest is the count is not stopping, despite the president's wishes. And the reality is he shouldn't want the count to stop because he needs to erase Joe Biden's lead in Nevada and Arizona. The president's counting on making a comeback with some outstanding votes in those states. What he really wants is the count to stop in Pennsylvania, Georgia, and North Carolina, where he leads, but Biden has been making gains.
All right, so the election was Tuesday, and we knew that there was a good chance we wouldn't have a result Tuesday night. It is Thursday. Why so much uncertainty as of this late, as of 2 days later?
Well, I mean, the short answer is expanded mail-in voting because, you know, typically you have the counting of absentee ballots after election day. That's totally normal, but the volume is often small enough that it won't change the outcome one way or the other. But this year, of course, votes are arriving by mail in huge quantities, and they absolutely can change the outcome. And there's also different rules in different states. I mean, Pennsylvania is a great example, and it's in the spotlight right now. Because of the state law there, they couldn't start counting mailed-in ballots until election day, so they didn't get that head start. And also, they'll keep counting anything that arrives as late as tomorrow, as long as it was postmarked by election day. So sort of by definition, it's going to take a long time to finish the tally in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I was struck watching the Nevada press conference earlier this afternoon. At one point, he talked about votes that they have until November 12th to count. So, I mean, that's the very last ballot. But do we have a sense when enough votes will be counted to be able to call the race?
You know, it's looking more and more like the uncertainty could spill into the weekend. And I think that the big twist here, Tiziana, is Arizona, right? Because news outlets that use the Associated Press to make calls, including WBUR and NPR, have already called Arizona for Biden.
Right.
And so has Fox News. In fact, they called it pretty early on election night. And so they give Biden 264 electoral votes. But other outlets have not called Arizona and have Biden down at 253. Now, that's a huge difference once you factor in Nevada, which you just mentioned, right? Nevada's got six electoral votes. If Nevada were to be settled in favor of Biden before there's a consensus on Arizona, we could have a situation where some outlets have declared Biden the overall winner with that magic number of 270, and others say he's still short because they haven't yet given him Arizona.
That's kind of scary. I mean,
it's
a little bit of a nightmare. Yeah. So yesterday we interrogated a bit of what our political divides are nationally, locally, what they mean for our future. I was interested. You dove into how those divides played out in Massachusetts and some reporting you did. So tell me what surprised you this week most here in the Commonwealth.
Well, you know, maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but I was struck anyway by how the pandemic may have actually made voters' political bubbles even worse because we've all shrunk our social circles since March and maybe surrounded by people who think like us even more so than usual. So I'm working on a story about this right now, Tiziana, and I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. I spoke today with a Trump voter named Dustin Voss. He lives in Templeton, which is one of those red pockets in this deep blue state. And this was his reaction to the result here.
I honestly thought that there was a possibility that Massachusetts could have turned red because of what I physically saw. I mean, in the town of Templeton, which is pretty small, there are Trump flags everywhere.
So think about that. I mean, all the pro-Trump enthusiasm that Voss was seeing on the ground where he lives skewed his sense of reality because, of course, Templeton is not at all representative of the rest of the state. But at the same time, I've also spoken with Biden voters in liberal enclaves who thought that Massachusetts would surely reject Donald Trump even more forcefully than it did 4 years ago. And actually, Trump's support here was almost identical to what it was in 2016.
But Senator Ed Markey, who's quite progressive, grew his margin. He won by 24 points in 2014, 10 points in 2013. This year, he won by 33 percentage points. So what's going on there?
Well, I think surprisingly enough, the primary challenge from Congressman Joe Kennedy actually made Markey stronger. You know, the Kennedy name naturally attracted national attention to the race, and Markey made the most of that spotlight. You know, progressive voters and particularly young climate activists rallied to Markey's defense and helped deliver him a double-digit win over Kennedy in September, and then he carried that momentum into the general election. And I will say, Tiziana, you know, politicians are never more accessible than when they're winning. And so the senator actually called me on election night because he wanted to talk. And I asked him about how this campaign has raised his profile. And this is what he told me.
Well, you know, my goal in introducing the Green New Deal was to elevate climate change, to make it a national issue, to make it a front burner issue. And I think that's what happened when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and I put it out there. And then I ran on that.
So you hear Markey's careful to say that he wanted to elevate the issue of climate change, not himself, but the numbers say that he's much better known and even more popular than ever here.
Yeah, let's talk about the ballot questions, too. Very little changes on that front. One big win, the Right to Repair campaign, which you had covered some for us. It'll expand access to motor vehicle repair data. You know, is this a big deal that it passed? What will it mean, remind us, for Massachusetts auto owners?
You know, I'd call it a medium-sized deal because I think that there was some hyperbole on both sides about how high the stakes were. But what it basically means is that automakers, beginning in the 2022 model year, are going to have to make more mechanical data that they collect wirelessly right now available to drivers. And they're going to do that through a new mobile app. And then with driver's consent, that can also be accessible to independent repair shops through a new database. And so for drivers, that basically will mean that you may get more marketing, more advertising, frankly, from your local mechanic saying, hey, we detect that your brakes are wearing down. You should come in and schedule maintenance.
All right. So the other ballot question was ranked choice voting, which often is associated as being a progressive position. It failed. You wrote for BUR in your election roundup that Massachusetts showed its traditional side on that one. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, what I mean by that is that, you know, Massachusetts is known for its liberalism. And as you say, this issue is billed as a progressive reform. And it did prove popular in those deep blue pockets like Cambridge and Amherst. But in lighter blue places like Worcester and Springfield, voters were just not ready to change the way they've been casting ballots all their lives. Why is that? I mean, I think the system can be kind of confusing. I mean, a really stark example is the Yes campaign couldn't even convince Fall River, of all places, where they had that very messy mayoral race last year where Jaisal Correa, under indictment, was recalled and then reelected the same day because the vote was split among five different candidates. In a ranked choice ballot, the people who wanted to recall him could have ranked him last and perhaps he would have lost.
All right, let's go back to the presidential election to wrap up here. Still a lot of unknowns. What are you watching for today, tomorrow?
You know, I think the big thing is Pennsylvania. I'm really watching how that gap is narrowing, and count me among those who thought with the president's large lead on election night that it was just going to be too big of a canyon for Biden to close. And yet he continues to make up ground. So that's where I'm watching. I thought that maybe Nevada would give us a conclusion before Pennsylvania mattered. But now I've got my eyes back on the Keystone State.
WBUR's Callum Borchers. Thanks, Callum. I appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
We learned from the presidential race in 2000 that the longer we go without a winner, the more likely that the courts are going to get involved. And the Trump administration made it clear before Election Day that they had a strategy in place to legally challenge a delayed vote count. So let's find out then what can and can't happen in the court. Renee Landers joins us. She is a professor of law at Suffolk University, where she teaches constitutional law. Welcome back to the program, Renee Landers.
Thank you very much for having me, Tiziana.
Okay, so we know President Trump's campaign yesterday filed lawsuits in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Nevada, Georgia. This morning, a Chatham County judge dismissed the Georgia lawsuit. Later, a Michigan Court of Claims ruled against a Trump challenge there. What do we know about the status of any remaining suits, Renee, and what are you watching for?
Well, he had a small victory earlier today in Pennsylvania where the court allowed, granted his motion to allow his observers of a count to sit closer, to be in closer proximity to the election officials who were making the count. The Biden campaign's response was, you know, that it didn't really matter how close or far away the observers were, just as long as the election officials were able to do their jobs. I was struck by the conversation you were just having with your colleague because President Trump is doing a typical thing for him, which is he's challenging, he's asking for the vote to continue in places where he needs to make up ground, and he's calling for it to be stopped where he is ahead. This is just not a very principled approach to the integrity of the election process. And so I think that the courts, I think that the one lesson from Bush v. Gore is to let all the votes be counted. And I think that the courts are going to be trying to ensure that all the votes that should be counted will be counted. And I think that that's another important lesson from Bush v. Gore.
You know, I keep coming back to the distinction, being not a lawyer, between what the president can do legally and what he might try to do, to the point you just made. Earlier today, he tweeted in all caps, quote, "If you count the legal votes, I easily win the election. If you count the illegal and late votes, they can steal the election from us," exclamation point, end quote. Obviously, he's, you know, there's misinformation there about what's a legal vote, what's an illegal vote. But what can the president do? Can he file any suit he wants? Can he challenge as many votes as he wants, wherever he wants?
Well, I had a client ask me, have you written this contract so no one can sue me? And the answer to that question is no. That people can always try to sue you. And the question only then is, what the law says about the nature of the suit and whether there's a legitimate claim. And I think that the president has, for a long time, you know, regardless of, you know, who people voted for, has tried to undermine the legitimacy of the election and any election law that he does not like. And so you had referenced earlier in your conversation this law, I think it's actually North Carolina, not Nevada, which allows mail-in ballots to be counted if they arrive by November 12th, which, you know, is next
actually,
week.
Nevada's actual deadline, last day they can count is November 12th.
Oh, it is? Okay. That may be true too. Yes. All right. So what I'm looking at doesn't have the date for Nevada, so I apologize. But the point is that, you know, that's the law, and the people who cast their ballots in reliance on these procedures, their votes should be counted. And I think that the whole effort in this election of 2020 has been to try to make voting as hard as possible for people and to resist efforts to make it easier. And I think that people demonstrated by the amazing turnout that they really want to vote, and that I think that the outcomes, one of the outcomes of the election will be that expanding opportunities and ways for people to vote, just like a lot of other things that have changed as a result of COVID, will be here to stay, and that it will not have a detrimental effect on the integrity of the election process.
We're talking with Professor Renee Landers of Suffolk University. I want to play a quick cut from you from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. This was yesterday. He was talking to reporters, claiming that the president's words and actions around the legal pursuit here have not been unusual.
Going to court is the way we resolve uncertainty in our country. So, no, I'm not troubled at all by the president suggesting that, because the other side's already doing it, too. You can anticipate in close elections, both sides will be lawyered up and we'll end up in court. It's happened over and over and over again. Nothing unusual.
Is that true?
I think it essentially is true that's why all these states have provisions for challenging the vote counts in close elections. But I do think that there is more of a, because of the back and forth and the debates over what kinds of election procedures and voting procedures should be permissible. Because of that, the whole process has become somewhat more contentious than it was in the past. I mean, maybe even a lot more contentious than it was in the past. So I think that that he may be kind of technically true, that there have always been legal avenues to contest election procedures, vote counts, that sort of thing. I think that the current environment makes it more likely that those things will happen.
And is the Biden campaign taking action in the courts as well?
I have not found a lot of evidence of that, but I don't anticipate that they would be shy about challenging actions that they think that are not correct. either because they disadvantage the vice president or because, they do think that there is some legal requirement that was not observed.
Okay, so middle of the night, Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, depend on how you want to count it, the president talked about going to the Supreme Court. I remember the year 2000, Bush v. Gore, and the role the court played there. We just went through arguably one of the most controversial partisan confirmation hearings for a Supreme Court justice. So I think this is important. Constitutionally speaking, what is the appropriate role of the Supreme Court in determining electoral challenges?
So I think that a lot of people think that the court made a big mistake by intervening in the 2000 election, which led to the decision in Bush v. Gore, which essentially stopped the recount in parts of Florida, and which meant that the election and the electoral votes in Florida went to George W. Bush instead of Al Gore. The ultimate outcome, is that, Gore did win the popular vote by about 500,000 votes in that election. So I think that the court is going to be very wary about putting its, its thumb on the scale in a situation like that in the future. I think that they might, if there is, some clearly established problem with the electoral process in a particular area, that might give them some opening to take the case, but I think they're going to be very wary of doing it. The other thing is, you mentioned the connection to the recently contentious confirmation process for Amy Coney Barrett, who started participating in court activities this week. Because the president is sometimes his own worst enemy in these things, because he announced that his intention of putting her on the court was so that he would have another vote to give the election to himself, makes it, I think, really hard for her to participate in the case, should a case come before the Supreme Court, not because of something she did necessarily, but because of this appearance problem that the president's words have created. And so I think that makes it a very fraught situation for the court. And I think that they're going to make every effort to stay out of it at this time. Also, the president was not, technically correct. I mean, he can't just go directly to the Supreme Court on these things. He has to, if he wants to litigate certain election outcomes, he needs to work his way through the lower federal courts like other litigants.
All right, so I have one last question for you. So far, both sides have been respected the rulings in the cases that have come out. What systems or mechanisms do we have in place if one of the parties here decides not to accept a ruling from the courts as legitimate?
This is uncharted territory. So I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I think that there will be a limit to the, to the willingness of most of the litigants and the lawyers to sort of countenance some kind of inappropriate defiance of a court decision in these kinds of situations. I guess one concern is that there have been reports of, sort of armed people kind of lurking around the vote counting processes in a couple of states. That is kind of concerning and, could lead to, some kind of law enforcement intervention, which really honestly should not have to be necessary, that people should respect the court decisions and the procedures that election officials have put in place in good faith.
All right. That is Renee Landers, professor of law at Suffolk, where she teaches constitutional law. Renee, thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Yesterday, while we counted ballots, the U.S. also counted a record-breaking 100,000 new coronavirus cases. Massachusetts reported its highest daily infection number since May, with more than 1,600 new cases. And at midnight tonight, everyone over the age of 5 will have to start wearing a mask in public in the Commonwealth, period. There will be a 10 p.m. stay-at-home advisory. Businesses, including liquor stores, will have to close at 9:30, and restaurants can't serve alcohol or seat new guests after 9:30. And the allowed capacity for groups in both public and private spaces will drop. Will it work to stop the spread, and at what costs? Did Governor Baker choose the right trade-offs here? To help you judge that for yourself, we have one of our medical experts, and in a few minutes, the head of the Massachusetts Restaurant Association, and they're taking your calls. If you have questions for either of them, call 1-800-423-8255. Let's start here with Dr. Shira Derone. She is an infectious disease physician and a hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Derone often joins us to take your coronavirus calls, as she is today. And again, that number is 1-800-423-8255. Dr. Derone, welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
All right, so we have seen numbers rise over the last couple of weeks here in the state. Both new cases, positivity rate has fluctuated, hospitalizations are up. Do we know where the spread is coming from?
Well, we know more than we did last week, which is good, because we now have the publicly facing, essentially, new dashboard that came out with the weekly report last Thursday that shows us the result of reverse contact tracing. That's something I've mentioned a number of times here that we've been wanting to see with more transparency on the public-facing website, and we have that now, which is great.
So explain what you can see now that you couldn't see before, Dr. Derone, and why that makes such a difference.
So what we see now is a list of exposure settings, different areas where exposure might be occurring, and how many clusters of infection occurred over a given time period in each of those settings, and how many confirmed cases were associated with those clusters. And what that helps us understand is the data-driven way in which Governor Baker and his administration are making changes releasing advisories and orders in order to stem the current rising tide of infections.
All right, I want to talk about age distribution here too, because the age of the largest group of those infected now is below 50 years old. The Boston Globe reported this week that that age cohort represents more than 70% of new cases. And we've been hearing about infections among younger age groups from the governor, from Mayor Walsh of Boston. Should this be surprising, and is it alarming to you that we're seeing a younger age cohort now as the primary sort of age group of spread?
It's not surprising, and it's also not really alarming. It is, to a very large degree, an artifact of testing. In the what we call our first wave here in Massachusetts, and we were lucky to really have a wave that came all the way down to a low number and now is going back up. In that first wave, we really didn't have testing capacity that allowed us to do tests on asymptomatic people or even mildly symptomatic people. And so the cases that we detected, that we recognized, were the sickest people. And because we know that age is such a risk factor for severe disease, we detected disease in mostly older people. That doesn't mean that younger people weren't out and about doing the same things and acquiring the infection. It just means that they weren't ending up in the hospital getting tested. And so what we're seeing now is a more true representation of the age distribution. Perhaps that we're also protecting our older individuals better, so we may actually have less infection in older individuals because of that. And what it means is that even if we reach the same number of cases that we had in the spring, and I hope we don't, but even if we did, we would expect a smaller proportion of them to end up hospitalized and having severe disease and death.
Let's go to the phones, Dr. Derone. 800-423-8255 is the number to call. We have Aaron on the line from Wellesley. Aaron, go ahead.
Hey, I have kids in hockey, youth hockey, and 2 weeks ago they shut down hockey in Massachusetts, and it's supposed to resume this Saturday. And I don't know if you know if there's any new rules or changes they've come up with, but I'm just kind of wondering.
So, Aaron, I don't know. I'll turn it to Dr. Derone in a minute, but I'll also see if we can find anything out for you. Dr. Derone, go ahead.
Yeah, I haven't necessarily heard that the rules themselves are going to be changed. I could be wrong, but, you know, the issue was meant in many settings the rules not being closely adhered to, concerns about all of the social gatherings that surround hockey games, pregame dinners, lots of carpooling, et cetera, potentially without mask wearing, and all of that together, sort of all of those things layered on top of each other, resulting in a lot of infections, with the solution having been determined to be just a period of shutdown to let all of those infections kind of, you know, burn out before opening it back up again.
800-423-8255. Let's go to Elizabeth in Brighton. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I want to know, with regard to the rule about staying indoors, which takes effect tonight, between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m., how does that affect people who work and who get off work during those hours? For instance, my son works until midnight, and he needs half an hour to walk home. Is there an allowance made for people who deal with those circumstances?
Dr. Jerome, you're welcome to answer, or I can on that one.
Oh, no, you can. Go ahead.
So, yes, it is not an actual formal curfew. It's a stay-at-home advisory, and it does make allowances for people who are going to and from work, as well as to make essential purchases like groceries or to a pharmacy, Elizabeth, so that should be okay. Dr. Jerome, what is your reaction to the new restrictions that Governor Baker has put in place effective midnight tonight?
You know, I think we all agree that the numbers were rising, and there was something needed to be done, and I'm pretty pleased with the data-driven manner in which Governor Baker has implemented this last set of changes. It is directly responsive to the evidence, the scientific evidence, in terms of what we're seeing in those clusters, in terms of what we've been seeing in the daily dashboard.
We're going to talk to Bob Luz in a minute from the Restaurant Association. I did want to ask you, so now you can't seat somebody at a restaurant after 9:30. People have to be home at 10 for the stay-at-home advisory. At one level, with it being younger people who are being infected, I understand that. At another level, there's a piece of me thinking, well, the coronavirus doesn't care what time of day it is. So help me understand, or help listeners understand, why the timing of this makes sense. I mean, I understand it from an economic standpoint, but from a public health standpoint, does it make sense to you? Are you comfortable with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really tough, right? Will this work? We don't know. But does it make sense? Is it logical? And is it data-driven? Yes, it is. And Governor Baker has said it again and again. Where we are not seeing transmission is in businesses, in places where there is, you know, the public eye, where there are rules, where the business owner knows that if the rules aren't followed, they will be shut down. That's not where it's happening. Where the transmission is happening is behind closed doors, in social gatherings, and then in households. You know, it's sort of like that old adage, nothing good happens after midnight. that is when gatherings, especially of young people, especially of drunk people, especially of loud talking, maskless people, happen. And so it makes sense. I can't say that I necessarily have a strong prediction one way or another about whether it will work.
800-423-8255 to ask Dr. Shira Durone your coronavirus question. We have Lisa on the line from Berlin. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I have two questions about the mask mandate. The first one is, so for those of us who don't live in highly populated areas, you know, like we go running out on the street or walk dogs or whatever, and like pretty much don't see anybody out on the street. And I think Governor Baker had suggested that even if you can social distance, like you have to wear a mask outside, like what does this mean for those of us in the rural areas that don't encounter people on the street?
And what was your second question? Let's do them all at once, Lisa.
Okay, yeah. So my second question is a little more complicated. There was a study that was published in Nature on September 24th. They talked about masks and social distancing and everything. And one of their findings, which was very interesting, was that cloth masks emit 500% more particles than no mask at all. And I'm wondering about that in terms of, you know, the virus being on those fomites that are being ejected from the mask, like possibly increasing the spread. And also of concern to me is if you're breathing those 500% particles out, you're probably also breathing them in. And do you think that this could be of concern for your lungs if you're breathing in all of these dust particles or like fibers from the mask?
Thank you for that, Lisa. Dr. Daron, let's start with the second question, then we can do the first.
I think there have been a number of studies now looking at different types of masks, and I do caution people not to necessarily put too much stock in one or another study that might look at one or another brand of mask. Overall, as a whole, any mask, any face covering is better than no face covering. And, you know, people get, you know, somewhat hung up on, you know, whether it's a gaiter or whether it has a valve. And, you know, really the mask that's going to work for you is the mask that you'll wear, the mask that you won't lose, the mask that you'll keep near you at all times. And so I really don't like to split hairs about the type of mask. I also think for the most part, all masks are safe. They are worn every day in many cultures, and certainly medical grade masks are very safe. We know that because we in healthcare we wear them all the time, and surgeons do cases that last, you know, 12, 16 hours and never take their mask off. So I do not believe there's any health hazards associated with masks unless there's an actual hazardous material being used, and I think for the most part they work.
Let's see if we can grab another call here. We have Jeff on the line from Shirley. Jeff, go ahead.
Taking my call. I had a question regarding outbreaks, and I shouldn't say outbreaks, but exposure in clusters in elementary and middle schools. I'm a father of two. We chose to keep our kids home until we kind of got a better idea of what we're dealing with. So I'm interested to hear how there's any clusters or outbreaks at schools, or is it kind of, you know, what we're hearing, a safe place for kids to be?
Dr. Daron.
Yeah, so the good news is that things are going really well in schools, especially schools that are following all the rules. The number of clusters and cases associated with schools in Massachusetts is, you know, one of the smallest numbers on the new dashboard, so that's great. And I am a strong believer that schools are essential for children, for their education and their development. And now we know that they are also a safe place to be, provided that the rules are followed. In terms of outbreaks, the governor has committed to deploying a mobile unit if a school does have an outbreak with a certain number of cases and evidence of transmission within schools, so a particular school. So there is that resource available for schools to control any kind of cluster the moment they recognize it, which is also terrific.
Dr. Daron, I want to thank you, listeners. I know there are more calls out there for Dr. Daron. We will do this again. I'm going to turn to another voice. So Dr. Shira Daron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Thanks, as always, for giving so generously of your time to our listeners.
Thank you.
All right, so I want to bring the voice into this conversation now, Bob Luz, who is the president and CEO of the Massachusetts Restaurant Association. Bob, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me on.
So we've checked in a number of times since the beginning of the pandemic, and the rules that go into effect at midnight tonight affect restaurants. You wrote a letter to Governor Baker today in response to the restrictions. I wonder if you can tell our listeners basically what the letter said and what you asked of the administration.
Sure. And there's actually a good news that I can update you with from our perspective. So, all the restaurant groups on there, certainly myself at the Massachusetts Restaurant Association, our board, all appreciate the fact that the governor and his administration have done an incredible amount of hard work in trying to lead us through just an awful time, a terrible time. And we appreciate the hard decisions that they've had to make. And we've worked very, very closely with his administration to make sure that during reopening and since, that we've operated very, very strongly and very closely following the protocols, and we've proven that we have. And so when the announcement came out earlier this week, the announcement said that guests had to be out of the restaurant by 9:30. And I think, you know, I'm of the mindset that some decisions were made without really understanding fully the whole dining experience or the whole restaurant experience. And, you know, what that meant is if our guests had to be buttoned up and out the door by 9:30, certainly the absolute latest we could seat anybody would be 8 o'clock, and that would really be pushing them along pretty good. And so that half hour is critical. And when we read the order, there was no question. It said that there could not be alcohol sold or delivered after 9:30, that we could not have any new guests sit in our dining rooms after 9:30. But nowhere did it say that the guests had to leave by 9:30. And so our contention was, and our we had legal counsel look at it, and they affirmed it through the forms, that in fact my reading of it was correct, and that the guests did not have to be out by 9:30. And so we asked that they consider that they also review it. And I can tell you that as of late this afternoon or early this afternoon, Lieutenant Governor informed me that, in fact, that the administration is in agreement with that. So we've addressed that, and we certainly appreciate them agreeing with us on that interpretation.
So now we know that patrons can be in the restaurant until 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah. So in other words, you know, if you come in, you can order a glass of wine as long as it's delivered by 9:29, and you have a piece of a great chicken dinner or a steak dinner or a pasta dinner, you can enjoy that and finish up your wine, finish up your dinner, and then again be on the road by 10 o'clock. And our whole contention was, if I'm home with my wife at 10 o'clock, or if I'm in my car on my way home at 10 o'clock with my wife, it's the same thing. And luckily, the administration realized how important that half hour is to the industry. It's critical, and what a difference it would make. And so we appreciate them, agreeing with us on this.
That is good news for the industry. I know that you also asked for an additional hour on those peak important nights, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. Did you receive a response from the administration on that request?
Yeah, so it's two different things. So there's no change to the executive order that was signed by the governor for this interpretation to have been accepted. So that was, I think, the Got easier it. Ask, and again, we appreciate that. It's a little bit harder now because it is a signed executive order. So we have asked for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at a minimum. We would love it to be seven nights, but certainly at a minimum, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, to extend it to 10:30, last call, guest out by 11. Again, this industry has been devastated like no other. I mean, everybody's been hurt, but no more so than the restaurant industry. And it's really a big deal inside of the greater Boston area. A younger clientele, more cosmopolitan, more international, they just eat dinner a little bit later. And so we're asking for them to reconsider it. 3 hours a week, 3 hours, could make the difference between life and death for a restaurant between November 1st or November 10th and April 1st. And really, the employment of our industry, all of our employees. There was so many restaurateurs that immediately said, if this goes through as is, I may have to furlough up to 40%, 50% of the people that I brought back, and they don't want to do that, and we don't want to do that. And so we're really asking the administration to look at this and reconsider how valuable 3 hours can be, because none of us wants to put employees back onto the state payroll. We want to keep them on our payroll, and we want to get to the other side of this to when we can reopen and offer outdoor seating as well.
Bob, I'm glad to hear that you've made some progress today. We are going to continue to check in with you and the association throughout the pandemic. Bob Luz is the president and CEO of the Massachusetts Restaurant Association. Thanks.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Living history and knowing that you're living history creates a real burden of responsibility on the leaders shaping that history, on those seeking to understand it, and on everyday citizens trying to decide what to do next. At the beginning of the week, we told you we'd bring you wisdom from members of our community as events unfolded to help us all make sense of it. So we invited our neighbor from Cambridge, David Gergen, back to the air today in that spirit. David has advised four U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton, and he's the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard, where he's a professor. David, thanks for coming back.
Hello, Tiziana. Good to talk to you.
So I'm going to start with a really simple question. Are you surprised at how tight this thing came out Tuesday night?
Yes,
and is still
I'm very surprised.
Coming up?
I think, you know, we all went in thinking that Biden had about an 8 or 10 point lead. He led in all the polls steadily months. And then to come out nearly, he's gone through a squeaker. We almost all had heart attacks that first night. Everybody I know in Cambridge went to bed depressed, trying to figure out if they had to move to Canada or something. And things have looked much better ever since.
So we know where you stand after that, too. David, I want to ask you. So one of the stories that I felt like those maps from Tuesday night showed me was how divided we are. We spent the show talking about that yesterday here at Radio Boston, talking about divisions.
We just so much need to understand and figure out how to build bridges to each other and listen respectfully and, you know, treat each other with dignity. I think lost dignity is clearly an issue in working class America. I do think on that score, we in Cambridge need to get out of the city and we get out of the bubble more often than we do to understand the rest of America.
You know, I've wondered about that, too. We've seen so much demographic data, both in the United States and globally, that people are moving out of rural areas, they're moving into cities, and that as that happens, we're living in two different countries and two different worlds. Have we ever been in that situation before in the country, and what do we do about it?
Oh, I think so. Now, I'm not the historian, but Doris Kearns Goodwin would argue that we're the most divided now since the 1850s. That was actually more divided, and look where it led. There are obviously dangers to this, dangers to democracy. We're jeopardizing our democracy. I think even though now Biden is emerging as a winner, in many ways this was a disappointing night for Democrats. They thought they would do much better, especially they would take the Senate. But now it's an uphill. They've got a slender chance of taking the Senate still, but there's a good chance that Mitch McConnell will be there, you know, the graveyard for all the Democrats' ideas. And, you know, there's even talk that Mitch McConnell is going to exercise a veto over Biden's cabinet choices, which would be unheard of. And the fact we're talking about it is somewhat scary. But we're in strange times.
You know, I saw a tweet earlier today pointing out that if Mitch McConnell does block Biden's cabinet secretaries, Biden, and this is again, if Biden is president, the results have not been called. I want to be really clear because we're a news organization about that. Should Biden become president and that happens, President Trump simply put in temporary appointees, and that was really considered destabilizing. Can you talk a little bit about that as a viable strategy if you can't get your cabinet members appointed?
That occurred to me that one way President Biden, if there is a President Biden, as you so well emphasized, how he would respond. I tell you, once one party starts knocking down the old barriers, the old norms, the other party feels quite entitled to do the same thing. So if McConnell were to do that, were to essentially exercise a veto, I think you'd find future Senate majority leaders in the Democratic side would do the same thing. That's what we saw happen to the filibuster rules. Once the Democrats started fiddling around with them, the Republicans said, "Well, we'll do that too." And now both sides are, you know, and the Republicans got their Supreme Court choices in by doing that. So it's not healthy when you start knocking down the checks and balances. You know, through our entire history, we had a sense of checks and balances. James Madison was wise enough to recognize that, as were other founders. And I think for the most part, it's just served us extremely well. But when we start throwing out these old traditions, you have to watch it. You can get yourself into a much, much worse place.
You teach at the Harvard Kennedy School, which used to be known as the Kennedy School of Government.
Yes.
We need government to work. The scenarios that you're laying out... The scenarios you're laying out don't seem to be played out by people who are committed to the government's got to work. How do we get back to that place?
Well, I think there is a considerable and a very reasonable question that conservatives have raised for a long time, and whether we're asking the government to do too much, and whether we wouldn't be better off to have communities have the government help raise the money, but let the communities decide how to, you know, spend it on what potholes and what they need to do with their schools and that sort of thing. I do think there's some wisdom in that. But the rest of it, I think, is creating a civic culture or recreating a civic culture. In which there are sort of traditions of respect and traditions that you can work across the aisle and not be seen to, betraying your country or betraying your party. And I do think one thing a President Biden, if there is one, would be good at. I think he'd be particularly good at healing. I think he'd be particularly good at reaching across the aisle, working with the other side. We need that. But whether it's going to be acceptable in this environment is really unclear. I think there have been two big questions about this election. Who's going to win, and can the winner govern? We almost know the winner, and I think it's going to look very likely to be Biden. But the question of whether he can govern, I think, is still very, very important, central, and potentially ominous.
You won't remember this, but I remember being at a panel you were on years ago. This was during the George W. Bush administration.
Uh-huh.
And I remember you saying, we were talking about budgets, and you talked about the fact that budgets are moral documents. Ballots are moral documents as well. And I wonder if you have a view of the moral story that America is telling right now.
I do, and it's not an uplifting story. We keep on coming up to the edge to do something serious about civil rights, racial inequities, and then we don't really deliver in the way we thought we would. And even now, after all the breakthroughs in the mid-60s on voting and, in restaurants where you could have dinner and that sort of thing, we're slipping backwards on voting rights. I think the way we treat our poor citizens, I think we've gone backwards. The insistence on high standards in education, which I thought was wise, was sort of shot down by a lot of community-based groups on that one. I thought having federal standards actually was the right way to go. But most importantly, we're seeing now as irresponsible citizens on the international stage, starting with climate, but going into so many other areas where we once exercised leadership, and I thought moral leadership. It was not only good for the United States, it was good for the world, that we had foreign aid programs, that we invested in others, that we brought people here, that we had wide open immigration standards to get students here, that we had the Peace Corps and so many other institutions like that we helped build. And we've walked back from all of that, starting with the Paris Climate Accord. And that, I think, is the story of immorality.
That is David Gergen, who advised four U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, where he's a professor and a neighbor in Cambridge. David, thank you for coming to join us today.
To
I really appreciate it.
Yeah,
thanks.
Take care. Bye.